Hello, listener. You are on a bonus overdose of the Plastic Pills podcast, where we are back today on Deleuze. And today's a treat because I have with me an OG Deleuze scholar and translator in Charles Stavall. Most of the people on this, or most of my listeners and viewers, happen to be younger than me, and I'm not even very old. That's why we're joined by Charles today, who is, with all due respect, old. And has been reading and writing and translating Deleuze since before most of us were born. So if you've read a lot of Deleuze, you may already know, unbeknownst or noticed to you, Charles' books, Gilles Deleuze ABCs and Gilles Deleuze Key Concepts. He also works with Daniel W. Smith, who is one of, if not the top, Anglophone Deleuze scholars and commentators in the world. And Charles, I didn't know this until I just checked, but you also translated the new edition of Deleuze's Logic of Sense.
Yes, indeed. That's an updated translation from the 1990 translation. Most people don't know that. It just sort of slipped out there onto the market, but we did a complete review. Constantine Bundes and I did a complete review of the original translation. So we made sure that we got our... crossed all our T's and dotted our I's for a change because the first one had some mistakes.
Well, that's disheartening because I only have the first one. I didn't know that the second one existed until
they're not huge. Don't worry, you won't go wrong. But it's nice to get things translated right.
All right, so you're hearing the voice, of course, of Charles Stavall, until recently professor of French studies at Wayne State. Is that right?
Correct.
And all this to say, if you're here, you're riding the Deleuze hype train, and there's a treat for you. So, Charles, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
First questions first, being the OG Deleuze scholar in the room, can you take us back to the beginning, maybe give us a picture of the academic climate when you were a grad student and after, and perhaps why Deleuze studies became a research project that you wanted to spend now so much time on?
Yeah, sure. Well, I started reading Deleuze back in the mid-70s when I was in graduate school at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And at that time, the U.S. was in a weird position because whereas structuralism in France, for all practical purposes, was done with by around the late 60s, early 70s, and they had moved on to what we've come to know as post-structuralism. In the U.S., there was a translation gap. Most of the people who were been reading structuralism were in French departments, reading it in French. But to make the breakout, of course, these isms have to get into translation. And so the structuralist stuff, and particularly a lot of Roland Barthes stuff at the time, really rolled out into translation in the 70s. What was odd about it was that also at the same time that was rolling out into translation were works by the major works of Foucault and Derrida. And the crazy thing about that was that you had this sort of layering of people sort of trying to absorb structuralism and not being, in many cases, not being fully aware of the differences between, say, what Bach might have been saying in the early 60s and what Foucault was saying in the early 70s or Derrida was saying in the early 70s. And so that kind of, that was my problem, was trying to sort all this stuff out, because when I came into graduate school, particularly at Champaign-Urbana in the mid-70s, there was all this stuff out there just, floating about, this thing we came to call just generally theory. And so it was sort of picking through all that that I came upon. I was actually more into Lacan than I was into Deleuze initially, and I was reading a lot of Lacan. And I met a group of guys at Champaign-Urbana, including Larry Grossberg, and who went on to become a rather well-known scholar in cultural studies. And Larry was trying to put together a working group, and we started off talking about Lacan and trying to get, come to terms with some of Lacan's essays. And then the next semester, we had the new translation of Anti-Oedipus on hand. And so he worked through that for a semester. And then we moved on to working on different essays by Foucault. And so it was with that seminar, with that project, that I started really trying to come to terms with Deleuze and not letting go of it. Like, you know, just not, okay, the semester's over, now I can move to Foucault. I mean, I really stuck with the anti-Oedipus text, tried to figure out why it was so perplexing, annoying, fascinating. And I just gradually, you know, like kudzu, started looking at Deleuze's other texts. And I'd also encountered Logic of Sense on a completely different track in French studies. Somebody I know had done an essay on using Logic of Sense pretty much in terms of literary studies, which, you know, struck me as really odd. The problem with Logic of Sense was at that point it was only available in French. And I really had a hard time making heads or tails of how this guy was moving back and forth between Lewis Carroll and, you know, logic and sense. And I really, it took me quite a few years to make sense of that. But the same was true of Anti-Oedipus. So that's pretty much how I got involved. And then I just started, you know, an academic career. And, you know, I hate to put it this way, but when you're in, particularly in those days, you kind of had to lay your cards down and hope for the best in terms of where you put your professional commitments. And there were a lot of different options in terms of being in French studies. And I was pretty much involved with reading narratology and reading Gérard Jeannette and a number of other French writers and more oriented towards literature. But I stuck with Deleuze and I just kept reading Deleuze and began to write little bits and pieces about him. So, you know, it just became an important part of what I was doing and thinking. So
this sounds like the time that academics my age dream back to as the good old days. All the French thinkers are coming into English, Foucault, Derrida, Lacan, and Deleuze. And so, I mean, you can confirm to me whether or not that rosy nostalgia is true or not, but did you focus on Deleuze out of all the stuff that you were reading because there was a lack of academic resources available, or because that was your favorite encounter?
It was a combination of the first couple aspects of the first. Favorite would have been strong, but it was the fact that in a lot of ways, I was in some cases, I was the only guy in the room who could read French.
Oh.
And so I'd end up, particularly in that seminar that I was mentioning with Larry Grossberg.
This is in Illinois, right?
Yeah, in Illinois. And but also subsequently, I go to, you know, when I go to a few, when I wasn't going to French conferences, when I was going to different other conferences, you know, there would be a lot of commentary about these writers, but had been read only in English. So I was sort of a lot of ways an annoying presence because of having actually read the things in French and not trying to lord that over anybody, but it just sometimes it can make a difference. And particularly when you're trying to work through an English translation, a thorny passage, and, you know, if you can have access to the French text and see what the original is trying to say, if that's clarifying. Sometimes it's tough in either language.
And you studied in France for a while too. I think I also read today.
I did an undergraduate year there, and I did my master's at the Sorbonne, and then I worked over there running junior year programs completely, you know. Part of my academic career was, you know, just getting these. In the late 70s, it was hard to get a job. And so I ran some junior year programs sort of to tide me over for a year. So I just lived in France. And, you know, that's an enriching experience all in itself, you know, just being around and soaking up the culture.
Yeah, this sounds like the rosy vision that every academic wishes they had a chance.
Yeah, well, it was rosy until you had to see what your paycheck was.
Yeah. So that's established. I want to give you a quick question that no doubt has a long answer, but I get this question everywhere I post, no matter what I post. So if we could just get it out of the way to start, I'd like to ask you this. Where do I start with Deleuze? And there's clearly a difference between his monographic texts and then his work with Guattari and now the lectures that you're going to discuss today. So where would you start if you think you're interested in Deleuze, but you're not sure yet?
Well, the shortest answer I can give you is I like the book that Deleuze came out with. It was published, I believe, in the original French was published in 1990, and then it was translated just a few years later. Negotiations is the translated title. Pour parler is the French title.
Did he oversee its publication? Because you're saying it's kind of collecting a whole bunch of his different works.
Well, it's published by his editor.
Okay.
Minuit. And so it came out in 1990. So basically what they did was to put together I'm looking at his introductory paragraph here, putting together some texts of discussions that took place over a 20-year period. And so it's basically a way of getting a lot of random things that were just floating around out there into print while he was still alive. And the reason I like this text is that it's a whole bunch of Deleuze's shorter texts, but it's chopped up into five sections. The first section's on Anti-Oedipus, as well as A Thousand Plateaus. The second one is about, second section's about cinema, different aspects on the cinema project. Third is on Foucault, and those essays are, those are interviews that Deleuze gave, and extremely important to, as sort of eventually the person then goes to read the book that Deleuze wrote on Foucault. You know, they really mesh with each other. The interviews enliven a lot of the texts that Deleuze wrote. He has a section, number four, it's called Philosophy, and it's a number of just general different takes that he has on different aspects of his philosophical undertaking. And one of the important essays in there is called Mediators, which is his idea of intercessor, or people who intercede within projects to help people along or help something along. And that's the idea of mediating between one thing and another. And it's a really cool idea that he comes up with. But he throws off all kinds of other interesting ideas getting to his point in those. And then the final one is Politics. It's only got two essays. And one of those is the postscript on Control Societies, which has its own status on. You can find that probably anywhere on the internet. And, you know, it's sort of the late Deleuze, where many people would have liked Deleuze to go if his health was better, if he'd been, you know, been more active somehow following his teaching career. But it's pretty revealing. And it's, you know, I think everybody knows that one who's reading Deleuze. But in any case, somebody who wanted to start, that's a sample. Of course, what that omits is that since it starts with A Thousand Plateaus with Anti-Oedipus and A Thousand Plateaus, that sort of cuts out all of Deleuze's philosophy prior to 1970. And that's, of course, the bulk of a lot of his interesting early stuff. And so it's not that you don't glean aspects of that in Negotiations. It's just that from there, for those, I think I'd suggest possibly looking at his book, short interview book that he did with Claire Parnet, Dialogues, although that tends to be more situated within the 70s as well. Or give myself a plug for the Deleuze's ABCs. The Abécédaire de Gilles Deleuze was an 8-hour interview that he did with Claire Parnet. He did this about a year after he retired from teaching, so this would be situated in 88 and 89. And It's structured as an A through Z type of topic discussion. So A is animal, B is drinking, which is boire, and on, C is in culture. And as he gets warmed up in the discussion with Parnay, he covers a lot of ground and brings up many of his topics that show up in the earlier works. And though you don't take any deep dives, for example, you don't take any deep dives into logic of sense information or difference in repetition. Nonetheless, you know, aspects of Kant, K as in Kant, is one of the letters, and Nietzsche pops up all the time in his discussion. So that's another accessible text, not a text so much as a DVD that you can just purchase online. Through anywhere, you know, you can just Google it. Gilles Deleuze from A to Z is the actual title, and those are you know, a couple different directions. My friend Dan Smith, I asked him, you know, what he thought of this question, and you know, he said, well, if you're interested in Nietzsche, then read the Nietzsche book. I mean, it's as simple as that. And if you're interested in Spinoza, there are several different Spinoza books. There's a long Spinoza book and a short Spinoza book. I'd say the short Spinoza book is a great place to start. That's the, sort of the deep end of the pool approach too. You know, if you want to read a text, we'll just go ahead and read it. And if you can't make any sense of it, well, there's lots of commentary out there to give you some direction. You know, subsequently, there have been a couple. There's about three different volumes that have come out of all of his random stuff. The material that was not published in, actually some of the material that was published in Negotiations is in those three volumes there.
Desert Islands is one of them.
Desert Islands, right. Two Regimes of Madness. And then the most recent one is Letters and Other Texts. And, you know, that has a lot of interesting, just a lot of interesting tidbits in there and reading to Liz's correspondence. He was an extraordinarily generous guy when it came to correspondence. I have about four or five letters from him that he wrote to me while I was a young professor, you know, in the 1980s. And, you know, the guy's generosity of just taking time out of his day to actually, you know, acknowledge and give you some information. And we were corresponding back and forth for several years, trying to set up a meeting, which eventually took place, but my schedule, his schedule, at some couple of years, it didn't work out. So
too bad you didn't have Zoom, eh?
Yeah, well, you know, you got to be able to plug in, download the app.
Yeah. So a lot of answers to where do I start? Might be the ABCs, might be La Bécédaire, if you can. I haven't seen that online yet, so maybe I'll look before I put this up and see if I can find a link to it.
That's the other thing that we were discussing earlier. If you go to YouTube and you know look for Deleuze ABC, you might be able to find all 26 or maybe 24 sections of it. The audio visual right there on YouTube. It just depends on. Right. Who's blocked it or not, you know,
right.
For copyright purposes.
Yeah, this was aired on French television, in case
anyone... It's actually not French. It was a European network, Arte.
Okay.
So it was published, it was, you know, broadcast across Europe with subtitles, I guess, managed by each of the national, national broadcasting companies. So if you saw it in Germany, you'd see it with the German subtitles and... That's, you know, Italy, Spain, you know, so France, no subtitles. And
That's
better to be in a country with subtitles.
Yeah, that's public funded broadcasting. I don't see a Deleuze Netflix special coming out anytime soon.
Yeah, not so much.
All right. So let's move into the actual meat of this interview, which is it sounds like an extended, giant swath of not a single project, but several projects called the Deleuze Seminars. So I'm not a Deleuze scholar, though I have read the books, most of them, not all. I like them, but often I, as a reader, don't really feel a compulsion to go beyond an author's work into the extra literary material. And this might sound like a mistake from what we've talked about already. This might sound like a mistake for me in this case. So what's unknown to many readers, including myself, is that the books, many of Deleuze's books, are actually the outputs or products of lectures and seminars that include other people, discussions. And you can see this most tellingly in A Thousand Plateaus, where the sources come from all over the place. They're from different academic departments, different disciplines. They're bouncing everywhere. And he didn't do all this work himself with just Guattari. It was a collaborative seminar environment. So, and this is a case with the other books too, which I didn't even know until I checked out Charles's work. So Charles, can you tell us a little bit about how these processes went in your understanding and why just reading the books alone might leave some gaps in your knowledge about the act in thought that's being performed there?
Okay, well, the way this got started was, again, through a gap. Dan Smith wanted to teach a seminar on Foucault, and he noticed that he wanted to really get into Foucault and Deleuze on Foucault, and he noticed that there are 26 lectures that Deleuze did on Foucault in 1985-86, but he noticed that some of the transcriptions hadn't even been done. And maybe I should back up and mention that from 1979 to the end of Deleuze's teaching in 1987, when he retired, there was a young man named Hidenobu Suzuki who came to France in 1979 to study literature. And somehow he heard about this guy out in the east of Paris at the Vincennes campus that was talking about all kinds of crazy stuff. And it turns out that since this guy liked Kafka, he wanted to learn about Kafka. He heard that this Deleuze guy had written a book on Kafka with some other crazy guy named Guattari. And so he went out to the lecture, and he quickly noticed that this room was packed. But he decided that this was kind of going beyond his French skills, so he took his tape recorder. And the rest is history. Hidenobu Suzuki turned out to be this absolutely strong-willed, disciplined young man, tech-oriented, great recording machine, apparently. And he would get there early enough so he could sit next to Deleuze year in, year out, recording every one of his lectures. And despite certain gaps, which you can imagine, this is, people are only human. Nonetheless, and this was old technology, by the way, so this was cassette recording. There are always little gaps at about minute 46 at the end of a cassette when the cassette has to change.
Right.
But
by the way, a lot of people who are listening to this might not even have ever held a cassette in their hands. So,
So when I'm listening and transcribing, I'm always waiting for minute 46. And you say, why 46 minutes? Because there are 45 minute cassettes that also had a little bit longer on the cassette that would go to about 46 and a half. So, subsequently, the Bibliothèque Nationale found this project to have been and part of what they call the patrimony of France. And so they acquired it from the young man and they digitized it. And now it's available through the Bibliothèque Nationale. And the French recordings you can listen to have been French directly from the Bibliothèque Nationale on their Gallica software. So, anyhow, jumping ahead, Dan found that there was gaps, and he wanted to try to fill in some of those gaps. So he got funding through his university, Purdue University, to fund the transcriptions. And this was the beginning of his project. Got several different grants, and then gradually came through the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, got a large grant from them. And so the project is to try to make sure we have the transcriptions that are accurate and translations that are faithful to those transcriptions and making them available publicly through Purdue's site, the Deleuze seminar site. Now, why listen to these at all? Going back to our earlier question, where do you start with Deleuze? If you're starting with Deleuze, then these things are probably, this site is probably not of that great interest. But one of the, and if you don't speak French, if you can't hear the audio and hear the interactions, that also, there's a certain aspect that Roland Barthes called the grain of the voice. You know, the grain of the voice really has a lot to do with it. But if you're just hearing some guy speaking French and it's not making any sense, that can be charming for about 10 seconds. And then, you know, you want to go on and do something else. But the translations, if you don't speak French, read French, the translations show, as much as we were able to do in print, the kind of atmosphere that reigned in his classrooms. And that's one of the amazing things about all this, is that the classrooms were predominantly Deleuze. Let's be frank. This is a professor who commanded a lot of respect, and he did a lot of work to prepare for each of his seminars. But these were in public French university classrooms, the seminars, and through many political upheavals on the university campuses, as well as in France more generally. So a lot of the seminars have people making wild interventions, and watching how Deleuze handles these things is just astonishing, because he is a master of diplomacy.
So there are hecklers in French higher education lectures.
Oh my God! And there are all kinds of hecklers. I mean, there are hecklers who come and just, you know, are there to be disruptive. But there are also the hecklers who think they know stuff. And there's this one guy throughout, year after year of reading these, listening to these tapes and reading, this one guy named, his name is Georges Comtesse. And this guy is very, very knowledgeable man. But he was basically Deleuze's nemesis, as it were. At some point during the course of any seminar, you could expect a Comtesse to sort of raise his hand, and you'd hear this soft voice gradually begin to build. And then he would just hold forth 15, 20 minutes, just giving these mini lectures. And Deleuze just came to accept that. In fact, Deleuze being smart, he invited the guy on certain, for the Foucault seminar. I mean, this guy knew a lot about Foucault, had a different take on Foucault than Deleuze. So Deleuze just let him at different points during the seminar hold forth. I mean, he'd invite him to, he'd structure it in to the seminar. And, you know, the guy was listening to him. He was so taken with his, he was so taken with every syllable that he said. You could tell he was so invested that no pearl that came out of his mouth was to be wasted. And but Deleuze, you know, got past that personal aspect and really was able to focus in a way that I've never experienced, able to focus on what the content was, to deal just with the substance and be able to respond to that. And an amazing thing. So I'm not really, I think I've sort of gotten sidetracked on the initial question of why read this stuff. It's to enrich one's understanding. There's a whole personal side to it. Let's take, I mean, the one that I can speak to, you know, I did all 20 of the lectures on The Fold, Deleuze's final, I don't say it wasn't his final book, but it was the final book on a specific philosopher, Leibniz. And the title of The Fold is, it's actually The Fold, Leibniz, and the Baroque. And he did two seminars on Leibniz. So this makes Leibniz kind of special in Deleuze land. The first were five lectures that he did in 1980, in the spring of 1980. And it's sort of, and I don't want to say it's Leibniz light, but it was Deleuze trying to come to terms with Leibniz quickly, efficiently, but thoroughly in a five-week group of lectures. But then he came back to Leibniz in 1986 and 87. And the reason was, there's several reasons why. One, he had already spent a year working on Foucault, 85, 86, and the book on Foucault came out. But prior to that, he had spent four full years working on cinema and philosophy. And those lectures informed the two books that he brought out, the Movement Image and the Time Image, two separate books. And the 4 years were Deleuze's attempt to try to actually come to terms with how cinema intersects with philosophy in ways that he felt were satisfying. And frankly, the craziest thing about these was that when you get to the end of year one, Deleuze basically says, hey, you know what, I kind of screwed up here. And so we're going to do a do-over in year two. And so sure enough, you come into the fall and he goes back over everything he had done in year one, but sort of twisted in a different direction. So you're working the same material, but like from a different angle. And so it's new. And then years three and four, we're developing the time image more and just extending. But the purpose of him to going through all this was coming through a huge project that was in the back of his mind for well over a decade. And that was his idea of doing a book on what is philosophy. And every one of these seminars, the Leibniz one in 1980, the Spinoza one that came in 1981, 4 years of cinema in 1982 to 1985, Foucault 1986, and the Leibniz in 1987, were all part of his much larger project of what is philosophy. And in fact, he says at the beginning of the 1986 seminar on Leibniz, he says, I really wanted to do a seminar on what is philosophy, but I just didn't have the courage to face this yet. And so for him, this was a massive idea, massive project. But one of the things you discover in listening to or reading through the Leibniz lectures, if you looked at the fold, if you've had the chance to try to work through the book, it is one of the tightest, most compressed. It's freeze. I call it freeze-dried Deleuze. I mean, every sentence is a morsel that if you were able to pour a little water onto it, it would expand out into all kinds of other stuff that you could say. And that's the amazing thing about following through the 20 lectures of the Leibniz seminars is it takes the material that you find in the fold chapter by chapter and just blows it up, blow it up and exploding it, but expanding it in ways that really bring in, you might have a reference here, a tiny footnote in the fold, which is 10 minutes of the particular lecture. And the other aspect is somewhere in the springtime, I have to look it up, but one of the lectures in the spring is dedicated to the topic of what is philosophy. And basically he lays out kind of the groundwork for what will become most of the opening chapter of what is philosophy, the large structure that he'll be developing. And he hasn't quite worked it all out yet. That takes a few more years and consulting with Guattari. But still, he's got in mind what he wants to do. So in this case, for example, the fold, it really gives you, I mean, I was in a group seminar on the fold with some friends about 15 years ago. And it never even occurred to me. It was right there at my fingertips. And it didn't even occur to me to look at the seminars and just to see, well, maybe they might offer us a little bit a different perspective. Yeah, they offer us a whole perspective. You want to know about the whole topic of point of view? He's got a whole 2.5-hour lecture on point of view. You want to learn about singularities? He looks at singularities from every angle, including the mathematical angle, and he brings in a mathematician from the department at Saint-Denis to discuss singularities from the mathematical perspective. And that's one of the most interesting lectures. I think it's on January 20th of 1987. So just an amazing lecture from somebody who came to the seminar and Deleuze said, hey, you want to talk about this? And, well, okay, why don't you do that? Isabel Stengers comes to talk about Whitehead. And there's a whole section in the 1987 spring, winter, spring part of the seminar where he talks about Leibniz and Whitehead in great detail, expanding that out. Whitehead makes a sort of a guest appearance in the fold, the book, but, you know, it's a quick on and a quick off, whereas Whitehead gets, you know, a lot of development. So it's a pretty interesting project. And year after year, you see how student input, Deleuze calling on the resources of the people he's come to know in the seminars over the years. And of course, these aren't just students. They're people who just come, take time out of their lives to be there on Tuesday, late Tuesday morning and into Tuesday afternoon to go to Deleuze's seminars. And they might be, you know, plumbers, they might be the widows who have, this is something what they do on Tuesday morning, and they sit in the front row. And that sounds more like Lacan than Deleuze. But nonetheless, you know, you have all manner of people. And that was one of the things that Deleuze really loved about his audience, was that there's this whole diversity there that he could draw upon as a resource for his work.
So he's a little bit of a celebrity. I just want to rephrase what you said, what you were saying. What we're talking about is the book on Leibniz, The Fold. And this book, I don't understand how anyone could read this without the internet, because the references are so broad. He's talking about music, then mathematics, then Leibniz, then some other philosopher. And I don't know how anyone, like, being alive now, I think makes this possible, but I had to read this book in front of the computer and basically Google every reference that he's bringing up, because it's constant and it's not organized. But you telling this story about, okay, there's a mathematics professor coming in, or there's an art person coming in, or a musicologist coming in. This kind of gives sense to why the book is written like that, because as a book, it's a nightmare. But if you're seeing this as the tip of the iceberg of a whole bunch of work, a whole bunch of lectures, a whole bunch of guests all coming in, then it kind of makes this book make a lot more sense. And you're saying that this isn't just the Leibniz book that does this, which is under 120 pages or so. Maybe it's about that.
130, yeah.
And then all of these books are like that, is what you're saying. So this seems like a kind of a necessary resource, unless you have Google, maybe.
I think of Leibniz as the extreme in that regard.
Okay.
Really, he was really, I'm going to make this as terse as I possibly can. And I don't know why. I don't think he really had a page length limitation in what he was writing. But the thing that your comment really makes me think of, that if you look also, another reason for looking at the, if you're into this book, The Fold, and you think, oh my God, what a hodgepodge, then you should look at the way he lays out his course, because his course is very, very, it of course follows the structure of the book.
Right.
But the way he lays out the course, it's very logical why you would have this particular unfolding, so to speak, in the way that he does it. And he organizes the course in two segments, one, Leibniz and philosophy, which corresponds roughly to chapters 1, 2, and 3. And then he deals with what he calls Leibniz and freedom. And that pretty much deals with what would correspond to the rest of the book after chapter maybe 3 or 4. But there he's dealing with the concept of freedom in a broad sense within Leibniz. And, you know, that was something that struck me as very, very odd when I was working on the translations, because when I had already read The Fold, and I thought to myself, freedom, what does that have to do with anything? And I realized, oh, duh, you missed it when you were reading through this the first two or three times. It's such an important concept, but it's just sort of a stealth concept that's working its way through all these other myriad concepts and theoreticians, as you mentioned, that are brought into sort of exemplify different aspects of the fold. I mean, the whole architectural aspect of the fold early on is something that can be extraordinarily off-putting if you've never considered Baroque architecture or, Baroque sculpture or anything. And that itself, in the book, it's really, really tight. He develops that in really interesting detail in the opening lectures of that seminar.
Yeah, so, I mean, I thought he was being deliberately obscurantist, so it's really helpful that I have you to tell me that this is what was happening, because it makes it seem like, okay, it was a very tight condensation of a whole lot of work from a whole lot of people, and we could say that about Deleuze's general philosophical project as well.
For sure.
If the books are highly abridged versions of the lectures, I'll ask for some links. But what are you doing with the project with Dan Smith, putting this all online? Is it going to be like open access? Is it going to be a book eventually, or a series of books? What do you have planned for that?
No books. It won't be any books. That's sort of a stipulation by the Deleuze family. He didn't want any of this stuff in print, but the opposite side of the coin is it's complete open access, free to anybody who can link on to it. So, and a lot of it's already available. The website is, for those of you who have a pencil ready.
I'll put it in the link so they can click on it.
Okay. So it's Deleuze.cla.purdue.edu, and that takes you to the front page, and then you just work your way from there. But one of the biggest discovery for me in this project, I got involved with this actually about 20 years ago, well before Dan had come up with this idea, because there's a musician named Richard Pinas who went to Deleuze's lectures and recorded a whole lot of them. He was less faithful, if you will, to attendance than Suzuki, but nonetheless, he attended a lot of them, and he had his own recordings. And so he transcribed his recordings and put a lot of them up onto his own website, as well as he had a part of his website for his music and a part of his website for Deleuze. And I got roped into starting to do translations of those transcriptions, the stuff that he had on his website, so that he could get a lot of the English translations and also other languages onto his website. And one of the things that I didn't realize at the time, and it's only been recently that I really become fully aware of this, is just how much he edited out in putting his transcripts up from the actual recordings that he made himself and that Suzuki made. So what I've had to do, I really become distrustful of anything that I haven't heard myself. And so I've just started to go through every single recording that I work on, and I have gotten a really nice little process worked out where I'll even if I have a transcript in hand, I'll listen to the recording I'll read the transcript first by itself and make my own edits on what I'm reading there if I see things that need to be cleaned, and then we'll go listen to it and then start filling in gaps, because there inevitably are gaps, some shorter and some longer, depending on who's done the transcribing. And it's only then do I go on to do the translation and try to make the translations actually be based on, what actually occurred. And a lot of times, some of the things I'm talking about as gaps, these are not significant in the sense that, oh my God, Stovall really captured that one word that makes everything different.
Right.
Not at all. I mean, a lot of times, even the hesitations Deleuze has that might get edited out by somebody who says, oh, we don't want to hear Deleuze going and ah.
Right.
Sometimes the hesitations are very, very significant, because he's thinking and working out the concepts as he's delivering them to the students. And he's got a lesson plan. He's got a little piece of paper in front of him, or several little pieces of paper, but he doesn't write out his lectures. He didn't write out his lectures. He just riffed off of his notes. And he would bring texts into class, of course, that he would read from. So he would have a reference book, and then he'd open up the book and he'd carefully read and comment on something. And so that would take a while. But so he was really prepared. But a lot of the times it was him creating a lot of this stuff with the students, generated by their interests and a lot of times by their questions, because certain questions would send him off in different directions, and he would answer questions really thoroughly. Or he would just say to the student, you know what, that's a great question. And what he would want to say was, don't send me down that rabbit hole, because that would be for him. And he would just circle back around to it and try to come back to it, if not in the class, in another session. But he really was attentive to that.
This brings me to a little bit of a more personal question, maybe, but it's something that I can only ask a few people in the world, including yourself. So you've listened to probably hours and hours and hours of these lectures, met with Deleuze. After reading him as a grad student compared to now having listened to his voice for so long, what insight do you have that you wouldn't have had from reading the books about Deleuze the man, or Deleuze the teacher, or maybe even Deleuze plus Guattari, his relationships and interactions and things like that?
Well,
I know that's an impossible thing to put into words.
Well, that's right. What I'm trying to do is put myself back in the framework. Let's go back to the 1970s, that rosy time. The problem with reading all of that stuff at the time was that I didn't have the full enough of a grasp of the historical and sociocultural stakes that were involved in, say, anti-Oedipus. I didn't understand why staking out a position against Freud and psychoanalysis was such a big deal. Why coming up with an alternate reading of Marx, not against Marx, but alternate reading of Marx within a sociocultural context, why that was such a big deal. And even to stake out a position, not against Lacan, but, you know, still, this was not full on Jacques Lacan, why that was such a big deal in 1972 when Anti-Oedipus came out. And I came to figure that out. And I realized that, you know, these guys had their own political commitments, but also intellectual commitments. And these intellectual commitments were things that then subsequently played out over the years and affected their lives. So what I didn't understand then was how post-structuralism as well, how the different kinds of what we've sort of categorized, you know, within bookshelves and conferences and so forth within certain categories, how this was alive within the culture, how it developed through the interplay between intellectuals in France in the 1960s and 1970s. And, you know, and Deleuze, in a lot of ways, was unusual. And then he stayed with his teaching career all the way to you know, completed a full career and then retired in 1987 and, you know, had done pretty much what he was able to do physically, having always been a little bit in ill health for various reasons. What I've gotten subsequently out of listening to these recordings is just, you know, the human side of this guy. It's just fascinating to hear how he deals with the stuff that all teachers have to deal with, you know, classroom time management, space issues, bureaucratic issues, trying to get students to complete forms. I mean, these don't, you know, these don't occupy huge amounts of time in these recordings, I have to confess, but that's precisely that. You'd hear, like, there's right at the end of one of the things I was just working on, he points out at the beginning of the class that, you know, there are these little yellow forms that you have to have, and I have to have, Liz has to have, so that I can go on and teach this next part of the semester. So be sure to fill those out. So he gets through the whole lecture. 2 hours later, he's wrapping things up, and he goes, oh, yeah, and the little yellow forms, the little yellow forms. Here you got this, you know, this renowned scholar, this philosopher. All of a sudden, could you? And then you hear him right next to the microphone. He's whispering. He said, "Oh God, I wish I didn't have to chase after them." You know, and it's so funny to hear. You know, that you think, oh my God, he's dealing with the same kind of stuff as teachers that we're all dealing with, and that was one of the reasons why he decided to retire when he did. He mentions this in the Abbé Sédère. He just basically got worn down by the bureaucracy, and he just felt that the demands on his time and the demands on teachers in general had come to a point where he had to part ways. It was just it was just there's not getting the payoff, and he also felt physically that he wasn't able to give what he felt was needed in his physical performances, because that's the other thing. You hear to what extent these are performances. I mean, he's just, when he's on, he's really on. And he's just investing all kinds of energy into these 2 hour sessions, and just keeping track of where he's going in this flow of ideas is amazing enough. But then to sort of invest this kind of, he creates different personalities as he's presenting stuff. He'll mimic stuff. He'll take on the personality of Leibniz, and he'll sort of, you know, channel inner Leibniz, or he'll throw in a little inner Nietzsche. And then when you're transcribing this, trying to figure out who's speaking here, that's one of the trickiest things, is to just try to, you know, sort those things out so that the reader will be able to understand that, okay, this is not Deleuze speaking in his own voice. This is him presenting Leibniz in a particular way, just to take one example.
And he said, this is just a personal question. He said, there's a lot of notes in his writing where he's borderline, he's ironic or sardonic or a little subversive. Does any of that trickiness come out in these lectures, or that feeling of him being a gadfly?
I think that the very nature of judging somebody to be a gadfly is that you're kind of a fly on the wall, just judging the guy. He's very, very genuine. You know, he's not trying. That's one of the things that he's very forthright about. He's really not trying to mess with anybody's mind. He's really not trying to play any games. He'll speak his mind pretty forthrightly. But on the other hand, he is really one of the kindest individuals. I mean, the way he deals with the students, even the students, particularly the students who are, you can tell, are the most endangered. There is this one student who, in the cinema seminars, I was listening to this recently. She has a crush on Deleuze, and she basically stands up in class and she wants to profess. She has the pretext is to give a presentation on a particular topic that they're discussing, but she basically just confesses in front of the whole class that she just wants to get to know him and hang out with him. And apparently she called him the weekend before at home and had been talking to him. So he kind of knew this was coming, that there was this issue, but the way he dealt with her was just so kind, honest, you know, like in front of all the students, you know, this really isn't going anywhere. But on the other hand, he asked her to come back, make sure that she came back the following week to discuss in the class the topic that she wanted to talk about, not her crush on Deleuze, but the literary topic. And so right. she does come back. Unfortunately, more fortunately, perhaps, I don't know, that presentation was never recorded. I think both Suzuki and Pinas cut off the recording at that point, and the recording starts up after her presentation. But Liz did ask her at the beginning of class the next time to speak. And, you know, it's just it. But that's an extreme. All the time, he's very, very conscious of being, you know, working with the students, of being careful with the students, and trying to help them, and making every effort in his lectures. You just hear it in the language he uses. It particularly is self-reproaches when he thinks he's gone too fast, when he thinks he hasn't developed something sufficiently. He'll go back over something. In fact, you know, some of the judgments that are made, or his harshest ones, are him on himself coming back and going back over something he felt he screwed up. So I don't know. I don't see any of what you described there in his actual personality. It's just somebody who had that generosity. I mean, the idea that he actually took time out back in 1985 to invite me over to his apartment to have a drink with this young American who, you know, had all these questions for him. And he just said, you know, basically was, you know, chill out, have a drink, let's just talk. And no, I'm not giving you an interview. And but, you know, it's nice to meet new people. And I understand now much better than I did then, you know, where that was coming from.
What kind of drink did he offer you?
I think I chose a whiskey. I mean, I had a whole choice, but I think I chose the whiskey.
Very nice. I wonder if the university administration or the department heads had the same impression of him as his students.
Ah, yes. Well, he got along with, you know, his immediate supervisors.
Right. Well, I mean, what is philosophy? He goes off on the bureaucratization and marketing dimensions of the university. Anyway, I have one more question for you.
Okay.
Because surely going through this stuff, raking the muck in the detail that you've done, offers a lot of surprises. So I just wanted to know if there's a surprise or moment or instance that sticks out to you in going through all this when your mind was just blown for a second and it forced you to reconsider your previous positions.
Well, mind blowing. Yeah. This would be the time where we would take a break and I could go, I could think about, I mean, I've had my mind blown, but not for the reasons that, you know, you just suggesting that I just had to sort of rethink everything. I guess the real wake up for me concerned the cinema books, because for me, the cinema books, for all practical purposes, were impenetrable, uninteresting and impenetrable until I started working on this project. And then I came to understand more clearly where he was coming from, what had preceded, and this was a long haul for him. Yeah. But he really had a commitment to this. He really had a commitment to trying to work through the concepts of cinema, work through the concepts of Bergson, because Bergson is the jumping off point for the cinema books. And I just hadn't I knew that, but I hadn't fully appreciated that. And then Charles Sanders Peirce and the Peircean structures, terminology that he brings to this project, that was always the most off-putting to me. Why bother in coming up with this sort of weird terminology for these different effects of cinema? I'm not really sure yet. I've fully answered that question for myself with any satisfaction, but I can see how in the lectures these are important turning points for just trying to conceptualize the different aspects of the movement image and the shift to the time image. I'm not sure still. And that was another misgiving I always had about the cinema books. I'm not sure that double structure really works. Mm-hmm. Doesn't satisfy me, frankly, very much in thinking about cinema. But then again, you know, I think about cinema in a very, very lazy sort of way. And I certainly admit that Deleuze isn't lazy when it comes to thinking through cinema. And that's, these books are proof to that.
All right. Wow. Okay, great. We are about at time here. So I have a closing question, but I'd like to first thank you, Charles. Charles Stivall, for hopping on with us today and for keeping us youngins in check. We cannot. We gotta revise our, you know, what we think are radical opinions every so once in a while. So please look at the links in the description if your appetite has been whetted. I'm going to go back through this when I edit and try to find all the things that have been referenced by Charles here. But most especially is the seminar project out of Purdue, co-project with Daniel W. Smith, and it sounds like a lot of other people. So I'll find as many links to that as I can. And it feels like we've barely scratched the surface here, even after over an hour. So I think people are getting a little more excited about Deleuze for whatever reason. And you, as someone who's almost dedicated your life to projects like this, would you say it's a worthy endeavor, even if you don't do it specifically in school? Is there enough Deleuze to keep you going for, you know, another lifetime?
Oh, yeah. Oh, goodness grief. Yes. Well, you know, I mean, this is my retirement now. So I'm enjoying it every day. I get up and I do a little Deleuze. So I think there's a lot to be said about that. A little Deleuze and a little yoga, you know, take you a long way.
Yeah. Most of the boomers are heading down to Florida at this point. So good on you. There you have it. This is Plastic Pills for the Plastic Pills podcast. We have an overdose episode with Charles Stivall. And, you know, based on your feedback, we might have to have Charles back if he has the time. So thanks so much, Charles.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I'll stop recording.